Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 5-0 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer. Bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming. News and discussions on gaming and gamer culture. Plus, reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers, it is episode 5-0 of Game On with Cody and John.
Episode 5-0, you want some special music to
bring
go
it on?
Here we go.
Yeah.
You like that?
Yeah, we've got a certain demographic of listener who probably has no idea what that is.
Yeah, but you know, for that demographic, what is that for that demographic? That's why 5-0 theme song. Get it, 5-0. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
Okay.
Funny guys. Speaking of funny guys, I'm Cody
and I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop games, board games, card games, role playing games, miniatures, war games, all the stuff that Wayne said in the intro there.
Yeah.
And we're coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, where we're a little less than a month out from Gen Con.
Yeah.
And
a week until football season.
That's right. So we can be happy again.
Yeah. I mean, we've got the Cincinnati Reds, of which we're both fans of.
Yes.
Doing very, very well.
Yes. Surprisingly well.
Surprisingly well. Indianapolis Colts getting ready to go in and have another great season. So
as of this recording, they've had 3 preseason losses, which we think is good for about 12 regular
season. That's right.
Season
wins. We don't care about the preseason.
That's right. And, you know, it's still the happy in the gaming capital of the world, even though Gen Con has passed.
That's right.
And what are we going to be talking about in this wonderful 50th episode?
We're going to be talking about what drives the game. Well, what works on the game mechanics.
Oh,
get it?
See
what I
did
there?
Yeah, mechanics.
No, but we're going to be talking about mechanics in both board games and RPGs. We're going to put in your thoughts and see and maybe kind of divine what the next new hotness will be.
Yeah, we got emails, we got voicemails, we got maybe some reviews coming up. Lots of great, exciting things for episode 50. So, want to get into it?
Let's do it.
All right. All right, well, you may notice that this is not the Game On Inbox segment, which is the way we almost start off.
You've
every
been
episode.
Bamboozled, it
You've
would
been
seem.
Horn-swoggled, Indeed. If you will. And this is our way of letting you know that we're making just a little bit of change to how we do our show. It's the 50th episode. We've been doing this podcast for 2 years.
That's hard to believe.
That's right. As of this recording, two years yesterday, I think, was when we released our first episode.
My contract's got to be up sometime.
I certainly hope so.
Ask for some... oh, thanks.
And so, you know, in honor of the 50th episode, we at Gen Con especially, Cody and I just sat down and talked about what have we done in our podcast and where do we want the show to go? You know, what is our identity? We had a great opportunity to talk to a lot of podcasters and get sort of their motivations and their goals for why they do their shows.
Hookers and blow.
That's the main reason.
No, no.
And so we wanted to figure out what are our motivations and goals. And so to that end...
we've made our first million.
Yeah.
We need to concentrate on the second million.
The second million is the hardest to make, I think. So we're going to just be changing things up a little bit. And, you know, it's all a big experiment. So if it doesn't work, we can change it up again. But we want to take our very segmented show and just make it a lot more free form.
Yeah. If you listen to our Gen Con episode, that's a little bit of where we want to go. We're still going to have, you know, big deal topics. We're still going to have, you know, the Game On Inbox and the hotline and do some reviews, but we're going to do so more in a conversational format.
That's right. Yeah. So we'll just be kind of segueing in and out of things. You'll get a review towards the beginning of the episode or maybe one towards the end, or, you know, we might read voicemails and emails, who knows when, but we want to basically keep it conversational because one of the things that Cody and I love to do is to sit and just talk about games, even when the microphones are turned off. And so, just turning the mics on, we feel like that's the best way to, you know, present our show to you is just us sitting around and talking. So, you know, and feel like, you know, you guys are a part of our game group.
Yeah.
You know, very remotely. And so, but, you know, so it's not going to be just this huge, don't turn off your iPod.
Yeah, it's not a mishmash of everything.
That's right. We're going to try to, you know, keep it very focused and have a lot of fun with it. But we hope that you'll enjoy sort of what we're going to be doing here. So, But, you know, we stand in tradition here.
That's right.
Sort of, I guess. Yeah, not. Yeah. I mean, but the main tradition is we still have a great sponsor in Myriad Games. And Cody, why don't you tell us what's going on with... Well, just tell us about Myriad Games. I'm not sure what's going on with them, but just tell us about them.
Game On with Cody and John is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional gaming stores everywhere. You can check them out at myriadgames.com. And a lot of the games we're going to talk about today, you can get through them. And you might ask why you would... You know, go online and not go to, you know, the Thought Hammers or the thing where you get
the Thought Hammer,
the Thought Hammers. No, you know, like the type.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway,
I thought you were saying, like, you know, I'm going down to the Kroger, or the that's a grocery store,
the Walmart.
Yeah, the Walmart.
But the level of service that you'll get from Dan and the team at Myriad Games is top notch. Case in point, I had pre-ordered the new Back to the Future game from Looney Labs.
Yes.
Because I'm a huge Looney Labs fanboy.
Huge.
And I didn't even know there were promo cards with it. There's one for Back to the Future and then one for Flux. I had no idea.
Huh.
Dan knew what I played, knew what I liked. And it's nice because, you know, even not in a sponsorship situation, you'll get in a nice relationship where they can... kind of forecast your needs, and they can really tailor a game buying experience for you.
Yeah.
So he added those to my list, and you know, it's little things like that make Myriad Games a quality game store.
And we also can't forget to just talk about the GameShare program, which is available you're at particular levels of their MVP program. You can find that out through MyriadGames.com. But, you know, it's like Netflix for games. And, you know, it's a great way to just be able to try out new games. We've got, I think, three games, yeah. two or three, something like that, I can't remember, coming to us this month of things we wanted to try out. And they're actually things that we... ordinarily would have just gone ahead and bought, but you know, since we have the opportunity to try them out ahead of time, we're definitely going to take that opportunity and see if we want them. So
yeah, what's really nice is, you know, we've talked a while back about, you know, making purchases a bigger deal, and Dungeon Quest is one of those where I never played the old version, but it looks really fun for me.
Yeah,
but you know, that's an expensive game, so through GameShare I can try that out. I can try it with my group, and then if I want to buy it, then I've already got it. And if I don't, then I just send it back and get something else.
Yeah, pretty awesome.
So MyriadGames.com, we thank them as always for sponsoring the program.
Hooray. All right, well, you know, let's talk about some games we've been playing.
Yes.
What have you been playing, Cody?
Well, it's been a while. So a bevy of games, as it were.
All right.
Let's see. We got a chance to play Cadwallon City of Thieves.
Oh, yeah.
You picked it up.
I did.
Yes.
It was my one impulse buy at the con.
You did really well this year.
I tried my best because I think very grimly back to 2 years ago when we'll call the AT-43 fiasco,
yep.
where I basically saw AT-43 and bought $100 worth of stuff. And you know, it sat in my closet.
How'd that go?
Not very well. So I, you know, tried my best not to have too many impulse purchases, but I showed up at the Fantasy Flight booth. There were three copies left, and I was like, I gotta get it.
It must be mine.
Yeah, so we played that one, and what'd you think of that one?
It's okay. I think it could really lead to some analysis paralysis. I think I'm just attuned to that because there's certain people that I game with that have the AP really, really bad, and it's just so frustrating. I'm just like, just move! You know, you have three options. Just pick one of them.
I'm not one of those people, am I?
No.
I didn't think so.
No. You just forget whose turn it is. Whose turn is it? It's yours. No, you're not just staring at the board in complete silence for 3 minutes.
No, that's true.
And everyone's just kind of awkwardly looking around. No, but Cadwallon, I like the idea and the, you know, Fantasy Flight quality, the components, the art, all of that was good. It was just, it was okay. I hate to use the word meh, but it was kind of meh, you know?
Yeah. It really seems to favor a lot of player interaction, you know? Mm-hmm. Kind of the idea of the game
We don't like interaction with people.
No. You each play a band of thieves, and you have kind of an action point system to be able to move them around. You're trying to get into the city, steal stuff by opening up chests, and then, you know, basically survive and get out of the city at a particular time.
Mm-hmm.
It's scenario-based, which is kind of cool. We just played through one scenario. I want to play it again because I think some of the other scenarios look a little more complex and better. But, you know, if you are looking for particular treasures and you don't get them, then you basically have to go and find the person who got that treasure and try to, you know, beat them up and take their stuff.
And the almost unforgivable sin for me is that they have all of these really nicely drawn up and sculpted characters, and in each gang has unique people in it, and they all have the same stats.
Yeah, that sucks.
That is, I just don't understand that. I mean, yeah, they each may have like a special ability or whatever, but, you know, the big brawny guy with the sword has the same strength as the little girl. You know, it's just, it didn't make any sense. I don't know why you'd go to that trouble.
Well, it makes sense to a certain extent, because if you don't make it that way, then it becomes this probably even a more laborious exercise of, all right, I'm moving, you know, Bob the thief. And what's his movement point? I mean, look down at the card. That's a 3. Okay, and I'm going to move this person. It's a 4. You know.
Yeah. Well, make all the movements the same then.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, because combat was basically just like, do you have any cards? Do you have any special cards? I have special cards to modify the roll, and we roll.
And then you roll.
That's true. I like dice, but I mean.
Yeah, it wasn't that.
It seemed lazy on my end. Yeah. And now you can get the painted miniatures for it.
Oh, yeah. I heard that. I heard they sold that set at Gen Con with painted miniatures. I heard it was really expensive.
Oh, yeah. You have to buy 2 sets. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, not to go into it too much, but there's basically like 2 guards, 2 patrolmen.
Yeah, and then there's like, 16 other miniatures in the game or something like that?
Yeah, but each set has 1 patrolman and then, you know, like 8 of the figures.
Uh-huh.
And they mix the gangs up, so I don't think you get a whole gang in one thing.
Oh, that's cheap.
And each set is like $30.
Oh, that's... So, wow.
Yeah.
And the game, I think, retails for $60,
exactly.
Right?
So you have to pretty much buy the game twice to get the painted minis.
Really ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm just... it's okay. I would play it again. I don't know if it's something I would pick up for my collection.
Yeah, okay. What else have you been playing?
Let's see. I played Back to the Future. We actually played this...
last week.
Yeah, last week we played a bunch of things. You know, I've got one on order from Myriad Dan, but we received a review copy from Looney Labs as well.
Thanks very much to Looney Labs for that demo copy.
And we played it. I was very interested to play it, not only because, like I mentioned, I'm a big Looney Labs fan. I was interested to see if this would just be kind of a cheap reprint of Chrononauts, or if they would really change some things. And I was very, very pleased with it.
Yeah. So, I mean, for those who might not be familiar with Chrononauts, could you just kind of give an overview of sort of how this game or Chrononauts, how this game works?
Yeah. Andy Looney came up with this this kind of timeline system for a game. So imagine, you know, you have, if you've seen the Back to the Future movies, you know, if Marty does something in the past, it'll influence something in the future. And that's how this kind of timeline system is maintained. The board it's not really a board, it's just made up of cards that represent different years.
Mm-hmm.
And in Back to the Future, there is an alternate version of that timeline on the other side. In Chrononauts, it was a bit more complicated. You had to patch, you know, paradoxes that would come up.
Yeah, it was kind of a cool idea, but it seemed a little complicated.
but essentially, you'll get, you know, in Chrononauts, for example, where they have alternate timelines, you might have where John Lennon doesn't get assassinated, or World War II doesn't end, things like that. And so how that plays out affects other things in the timeline. You know, there's linchpins and ripple points. If a linchpin changes, it will ripple through the timeline. It's like, well, if there's no, you know, oh, if heart, let's see, if Pearl Harbor doesn't get bombed, then say the U.S. doesn't get involved in World War II, for example.
Right.
You know, that's just
things like that.
Yeah.
And they're clever. I mean, it's kind of cool when those things flip over. Yeah. You're like, oh, that would be cool if that happened. Yeah.
But so Back to the Future is based on the trilogy, the entire trilogy. And at first I thought it was odd. I'm like, why is this license getting, you know, kind of regurgitated? You know, it's like who is clamoring for a Back to the Future game? But apparently there is, I think it's like the 25th anniversary of it.
Oh.
There was an old movie theater around our area that showed it again.
Oh, okay.
That shows classic movies. They showed that again, and they're coming out with a big Blu-ray set. So,
oh, cool.
I guess I didn't know. Now I know.
I need to go rent them all again because, I mean, I saw all of them in the theater, but it's been a really long time.
Yeah,
so.
they're good movies.
Yeah, definitely.
So basically, Andy Looney has taken the Chrononauts game, which was a very fun game in and of itself, but it had a few problems with it, like the patching system. You know, if you upset the timeline, you know, you might need a specific timeline in place to win. You know, I might need an alternate 1936, an alternate 1960, and a real life 1983, for example. And Chrononauts, it was a lot harder to get those things because you not only had to be able to flip that card, you had to be able to play another card and patch it.
Hmm.
And if that something happened to that patch, then you were kind of stuck. You know, you had to wait for it to come back or get it back in another way. With Back to the Future, it's been streamlined to where the alternate history is just on the back of the card now.
Yeah.
And, you know, when John and I played, it just, the whole thing just seemed a lot tighter and more focused. And it plays in, Chrononauts can probably go up to an hour. I would say Back to the Future is right around half an hour.
Right. And that's even if you have we played just two player games of it. If you played with multiple players, I think it would still be pretty short. And that was always the trouble with larger numbers of players for Chrononauts is that if you were looking for that particular linchpin or that particular patch, especially, you're just sitting there waiting for the deck to be reshuffled so it could come back around again. So this really does streamline it.
Yeah, and it's neat because they have a new end game mechanic where you have to pretty much fulfill your goals. The idea is you are a time traveler. You're a descendant of Biff Tannen or Marty McFly or Doc Brown, and you have to pretty much get the timeline the way you want it. And then this is the cool thing. You have to uninvent time travel to make sure your version is the final version.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, so it's, you know, you get all of these things in place, and then you have to flip the linchpin where Doc Brown invents the flux capacitor. And there's five of these cards, and one of them is the you successfully do it, and the other four are like mysterious forces prevent you from
achieving a game extender there. Yeah,
you know, it's basically there's four dummies, and then there's a win.
My favorite part of that card is the fact that all the cards have like a date and a time on them.
Uh-huh.
The time when the Emmett Brown invents the flux capacitor card, 420.
That's right. Yeah,
of course. If you know anything about Andy Looney, you'll understand that one.
Yeah, yep. So in playing that, I was just really impressed because my hopes were not that high for it. I thought it was just going to be kind of a, you know, just slapping on the Chrononauts engine and it wasn't going to feel really good. You can tell they've really put thought into this, and honestly, I hope they go back and remake Chrononauts more like this.
Yeah,
because I think the way they did it with the changing the timeline and some of the other cards you can get, it still feels like Chrononauts, but it definitely feels like that version two of it. You know, you're like, oh, this is much better. You know, they should just make it like this.
Yeah, yeah, this is definitely a buy for me. I think it's a really good game.
Yeah, so. Buy for me, and it's pretty neat because it's all illustrated. Like you know, they have the different time machines, they have the time train in it, and there are no photos or anything from the movie. It's all illustrated, and it's pretty well done.
Yeah, very well
done. Yeah, I mean, some of the cards are pretty sparse on artwork, which it could probably use a little punching up there.
Yeah.
But a lot of the, pretty much anytime there's an illustration, it's very well done. So they've really stepped up in the art department over the last few years. Looney Labs has. So.
And they have all these different versions of the time car.
Yeah, you go from the DeLorean to the time train that you see at the end of Back to the Future 3. So if you're a fan of Looney Labs games or Chrononauts, definitely try it out. But even if you've not played it, this game gives you a feel like you're influencing time and making decisions and kind of changing things up. So it's a lot of fun, and it's cheap, and it plays pretty quick. So check out Back to the Future, the card game.
Awesome. Let's see, some of the stuff I've been playing I had a couple of game nights. I was able to have a buddy over, a new friend from work named Pete, who is also a gamer. It was kind of, there was a very big dearth of gamers in my new job, and so I was a little worried.
Yeah.
But Pete just started, and he's very much a big old school gamer. He's got original copies of Titan and HeroQuest and things like that locked away in his closet. So
bring back the lunch table.
Yeah, oh, it could be, yeah. So we played a couple of games, including the new expansion for Dominion, Prosperity, which you and I also got to play, right? And, you know, it's another version of Prosperity. I mean, of Dominion.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting.
I'm getting a funny look from you.
Yeah, it's, you know, we played with just an all Prosperity set.
Right.
And, man, it gets wacky really quick. You know, you're like, okay, I've got 11 coins, so I'll get that. And you're like, what? You know,
like 11 coins. What? Yeah.
And I wonder how it will be mixed with the other sets.
Right.
But, you know, I think it's telling, you know, Kalen and I were talking about it, you know, because, you know, we have all the other Dominion sets, so we'll pick it up, but we're not in a real big hurry to, you know, it's from what I played, you know, it's well balanced. It seems to work with the rest of Dominion, but I don't know. It's like, how much Dominion do I need?
I feel like at this point I've got all the sets, which is like five sets now, I guess, the base game and four expansions, and I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm good. I mean, unless something comes out in the next expansion that is just, oh my gosh, game-changing mechanic, that's good.
The Miniatures Combat
expansion. Exactly. Then I'll be ready to purchase that. But otherwise, I mean, I'm really good. We've got enough copies of the game now to run a 50-person tournament,
right,
probably.
Yeah.
No, that's a little exaggerated. But, you know, so I think I'm good for that game. It's still my favorite game, maybe.
No.
I don't know. Yeah. We'll do our top 11 in the next couple of months here, and we'll see where it ends up. But it's definitely,
it's up there.
It's near the top.
It's still a good game. We don't want to give that impression.
No, it's still really good.
You know, it's
And one of the most, the, just to give you the background, the interesting mechanics in this new version of Prosperity is that you do have a new treasure card that's the Platinum card, which is worth five coin, and it's cost 9 to buy. And then you also have a new victory point card, the Colony, which is worth 10 victory points and costs 11 coin to buy. Right. So there's this, it's just sort of this natural power creep that they've built into this new version of the game.
10 is the new 7.
Yeah. And they have all these treasure cards that do different things now that give you special bonuses. The Horde is one that's real powerful. It costs 6 to buy. Mm-hmm. And then whenever you play it, it's worth 2 treasure. And then when you play that and then buy a victory point card on your turn, then you also get to get a gold card. So you're just basically able to generate 3 coin every time that you're doing that. So it makes the end game real powerful.
Yeah. I just hope they start slowing down a little bit on it.
Yeah.
Because we're just getting a lot of Dominion overkill. And with all of these other deck building games, like we'll mention later, I kind of want the old standby to be a little more measured and not try and keep up with all these young whippersnappers, as it were.
Yeah. But still a very fun game. Yep. Also played game of Innovation.
Yeah.
Which is a new card game from Asmodee Games. And I think I talked about it a lot in the Gen Con episode, is that was one that I played with Rafe Granger and Jeff Engelstein and a couple other people and had a real good time with that. Although when I played with Jeff and Rafe and Aaron, I was really confused by what I was doing. I mean, I just kind of just sat down real quick, and Jeff was sort of in the middle of the rules explanation. And so I just played cards. I didn't have any idea of what I was doing. I really didn't have any idea.
That's
what
a good
what
way
I was
to go
doing.
About it.
Yeah, I was just trying to get in on it. And now that I've bought the game and played it a couple of times, I've played it a couple of times with Pete. I've now played it 2 or 3 times with you and with a group of people, actually. Yeah. Love this game.
Yeah.
Really, really love this game. And so, you know, let's do, in our freeform method here, want to do a review?
Yeah.
All right, let's do a full review of Innovation. It'll turn you upside down, yeah. It's like a new innovation. You've got me on your mind. I'll start a new generation. Get up, I'm yours tonight. It's like a new innovation. This sound is so sublime. This calls for so we're not going to call this a buy, try, or deny, are
no.
we? This is just a review. Game on, Cody and John does reviews. Okay, and so we're
this
gonna,
is not awkward at all.
No. Welcome to the new format. No, so we're going to talk about Innovation, which is from the designer's name is Carl Chudik or Chudike. I don't.
You had trouble with that the last episode.
I did.
I can't help you out.
Yeah,
just call him Carl.
Hopefully, maybe as a Wikipedia page where you can click on the pronunciation, it'll say it. You know?
I think it's just Carl.
I'll just call him Carl. And it's from Asmodee Games. It's for, I don't know, maybe 12 and up, maybe. It's kind of hard. I don't know.
At least.
I don't have the box in front of me, so I don't know exactly what it is. But and it takes about an hour to play, between 30 minutes and an hour.
It depends on the amount of people. I think 2-player, you're looking closer to half an hour. And I think even with 4 players, an hour is on the really high end.
Right. And this may end up being a real big selling point for folks who like civilization building games, but don't want to play Through the Ages for 5 hours, you know. So, and we've talked about Through the Ages on previous shows and how much we like that game. This is a game that has that same sort of feel of building something, but it's very abstracted.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it's much more abstracted than Through the Ages, and Through the Ages is even a little bit abstracted.
Yeah, I mean, because it's all card based.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just and the art doesn't exactly draw you in. You know, mechanically, yeah. This game is very good, as John will mention, but the artwork and kind of the iconography, it's rough.
Yeah.
It's not great. Times New Roman text all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
it breaks the heart.
I didn't have that much of a problem with the art, but you're the art guy.
Yeah.
So the game consists of a big deck of cards, and it's actually multiple little decks of cards. You have 10 decks that each represent a particular age. And you're going to start off the game with 2 of the level 1 cards.
Prehistory, I believe it is.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
We'll go with that.
Sure. We're thorough. 2 of those cards in your hand, and all of the rest of the cards are going to be arranged. The decks are going to be arranged in a circle on the table. And then you're going to take 1 card from each of those decks and place it in the middle, kind of in a row. Each of these cards are not going to be used in the game except to score as achievements. The object of this game is to win, and the way that you win...
I can't do the D6G achievement.
That was a nice little achievement. Thank you. The way that you earn these achievements is well, lots of different ways, but one of the main ways you can earn achievements is by getting a certain number of points. You're going to be scoring cards, and if you get a certain number of points, then on your turn, you can claim one of these achievements. And the achievements get higher in point values as you go up there, and as far as the number of points that you need to be able to claim it. And depending on the number of players, you have to get a certain number of achievements. For a two-player game, you have to get 4. For a 4-player game, you have to get 6. A 3-player game, yeah, maybe it's 5.
We'll let you know when we play one.
Exactly. Yeah, we haven't played a 3-player game yet, though. And so on your turn, you're going to be able to do 1 of 4 different things. And actually, 2 of 4 different things, because you get 2 actions. And you can repeat the same thing over and over again, or you can do 2 different actions. You can either draw a card, in which case you're always going to draw a card that is equal to the highest level of card that you have on your board when it's sitting out in front of you. And so all of the cards have on the top right of the card, it'll say what level it is. And so you'll draw from that deck. You can do that 2 times if you want to. But drawing a card is one thing that you can do. You can also meld a card. I think it's a terrible... I know it's like an old school card game term, but I don't like the word meld.
You know, it's like Spock.
No, it's not anything mind like meld. Spock. That's why. That's why I don't like the word, is because it's nothing like the Spock mind meld.
Remember.
Okay. So melding a card is just placing it on the table. The cards have 5 different colors associated with them, and you can only have 1 of each color, you know, sitting in front of you. So you're going to have like 5 piles of cards in front of you, and that's your board. So melding a card is just laying down a card of a particular color. If there's already a card of that color on the board, then you'll just lay it right on top of it. The third thing that you can do, and this is sort of the main mechanic of the game, is the dogma action.
Yeah.
So I don't know why it's called dogma.
But I don't know either.
Yeah, the link between the theme and the mechanics of this game, a little bit hazy.
Tenuous.
Tenuous at best. All you're going to do with the dogma is you're going to take 1 of the cards that's the top card on your board, and you're going to, each card has some kind of ability on it. Plus there's a bunch of icons on the card, and you're going to, but don't be scared off by icons. This is not like Race for the Galaxy. Icons.
Now, you know, I played Race for the Galaxy for the first time, not to totally derail your view, but okay. This is free flowing conversation.
Go for it.
Right. Man, I loved it. And the game was fine, but the iconography, and I know that draws a lot of people off of it, man, that's my cup of tea. I would rather have an icon than a bunch of sentences, so kudos to them.
Okay.
So Race for the Galaxy is not bad, so no. don't sully its good name.
Yeah, but everyone, most people would agree that that's a difficult game to teach new people because of the iconography. Sure. I would say that this game, Innovation, is not difficult to... It's not the same.
No.
The iconography is not going to make this game difficult.
I'm just defending the honor of Race for the Galaxy.
Okay, well, well done, sir.
All right, so back to your review.
All right. So when you do a dogma action, you're going to look at the ability that's on this card. And there's going to be one of two kinds of abilities. There's either just sort of a regular ability, or there's an I demand ability. And so the regular abilities are things that you're going to be able to do with your cards to help to build your civilization. Next to the ability, there's going to be an icon that's going to match these icons that are on the card. So, for example, it might be a castle. And so what's going to happen is you're going to read that dogma action, and then you're going to say, this is a castle icon action. And you're able to do that action. If it's your dogma, you're always able to do it. But... the catch here is that any of your opponents that have the same number of castle icons, for example, as you do or more, will also be able to benefit from this action. This will be called a shared action.
Oh, they have to benefit.
Unless it says you may, huh? And so, and to top that off, they're also going to get to do that action before you. And so it might be one of those things where, you know, draw and meld a level 2 card. That'll be like the ability. Mm-hmm. So that means that if someone else has at least as many castle icons as you, they're going to be able to draw and meld that too before you. It'll get all the way back around to you. You'll be able to do the action. If anyone has shared that action with you, then you're going to have the opportunity to get a free draw. You're going to draw a card as kind of a consolation prize for having to share that ability. So that's how that kind of dogma action works. And then there's also the I demand dogma action, which is more of a, making other people do things to benefit you.
You have to say it in a scary voice. I demand.
I demand. And so in the I demand action, it would be like, you know, it'd be I demand that you give me the top card off of your blue pile and I'll score it or something like that. And then the way the icons work is that anybody who has less than the number of icons that you have of that type, they have to do that I demand portion. If they have the same or more of that icon, then they can refuse and they don't have to do it. So, you know, that's I think that's really kind of the cool interaction in the game, is because you can look around. These icons are big on these cards. Mm-hmm. So you can very easily look around at your opponents and see what they have, and from that decide what you want to do, whether you want to take an action or not.
Right. And with the two-action system where you get two actions on your turn, you know, John and I really found this out in a two-player game, is that if you really have an advantage in one icon over the other, you can just do that I demand twice.
Yeah.
I mean, you can just really exploit your opponent's weakness there in that two-player game. And, you know, to where they have to focus on really building that up and have to go off of their plan. So
yeah,
there's a lot of depth there.
And that brings up a good point. This game, very, very tactical, mm-hmm. not strategic.
Right.
It is not strategic at all. You know, you can look at your cards and say, I'm going to play this one first and then that one. But more often than not, you're going to be just on your toes the whole time about what, you know, trying to defend of what's going on around you.
I was surprised how kind of, I guess, not in your face because it's a Civilization game, but... You know, it was a lot of, you know, just being aware of your surroundings and getting ready to just take on the brunt of all these I demands and dogmas. And, you know, you're trying to advance your own civilization here, but a lot of it is you got to play some pretty good defense.
Yeah. One of the ways that you can give yourself an advantage in this game is through this very interesting mechanic called splaying.
Mm-hmm.
And splaying is where some actions might cause you to say that you can splay your cards right. And what you're going to do is basically take your stack of cards of that particular color, you know, maybe there's three or four or whatever, and you're going to shift them all and kind of fan them out so that the leftmost icon of each card is visible. So, and then, you know, your top card, you'll be able to see all the icons. So it basically gives you access to some of the icons from all the cards that you've laid down prior to that. And there's different things that allow you to splay left, splay right, or probably the best one is to splay up, mm-hmm. because you'll get even more icons visible. By, you know, more icons means that you get to do regular dogma actions by yourself, which means other people don't benefit, and you can force people to do those I demand actions. So having icons is a powerful thing.
Yeah, and one of the things you notice is as you advance through the ages.
Innovatively.
Yeah, innovatively. The icons start to change. You know, you may start to get factories in, you know, age 5 or 6,
yeah.
and you won't see any more castles. So, you know, that's an advantage for you, because if you're ahead of your opponents, well, they won't have any factory icons and you can just hammer them with that. But if they're still using, you know, archaic tactics and they have castles and you've, you know, moved beyond that, you know, they could still get you.
Yeah. And one nice thing that they've done to sort of, if you do find yourself behind and you're in, you know, I'm stuck in age 2 and I can't seem to really get any of these higher level cards, is what they call the empty pile rule. Is that if you have to draw a particular card from a pile and that pile is empty, then you will always draw from the highest pile. So this can be real beneficial, especially if someone has gotten ahead of you, and maybe you're drawing level 3 cards and they've already drawn all of the level 3, all the level 4, and they're drawing level 5 cards. Well, the next time you have to draw a level 3 card, you'll be drawing a level 5 card because those other things are empty. So that's a real good way to sort of play a little bit of a catch-up mechanism.
And that's also where, on the dogma actions, having your opponents go first is nice. Because mm-hmm. say it's draw 4, you know, they might draw that pile dead. And then when it gets around to you, well, guess I have to take a 5.
I got a 5, yeah. No. So that's pretty fun. The fourth thing that you can do in your turn, we talked about drawing, melding, dogma. The fourth thing is to achieve.
Yeah.
And this is how you get your points in the game and get these achievements. Yeah. There's two requirements for claiming an achievement. One, you have to have the correct number of points in your score pile. And we didn't talk too much about how you score points, but these dogma actions will say things like I think I mentioned before, a demand action that would say, give me the top card off of your whatever pile and score it. You know, I would then take a card that was off of Cody's board, turn it over, and then place it in my little score pile. You kind of tuck it under this reference card. And maybe if it was a level 3 card, well, then that's going to be worth 3 points. The level of the card is the number of points. Once you've accumulated like 5 points, then you're able to achieve the level 1 achievement. And they kind of go up in by fives. So the level two achievement is 10 points. It's basically the level times five. So if you have that number of points, and then the other stipulation is that the top card on your board, the highest level card on your board, has to be at least the level of the achievement that you want to achieve. So, you know,
it's real easy to forget that.
Oh yeah.
You can get, cause I kept getting caught up in getting points. And then, man, I've got to draw a six right. in order to buy something, you know?
Yeah. It's like, oh, I've got enough points for the level six achievement, but the highest card on my board's a five. Well, no.
Crud. I think the highest on mine was like a three.
Yeah.
You know?
And so that's when that empty pile rule can help mm-hmm. you out too. So there's also, a set of, what are they called? Special achievements, mm-hmm. which can be achieved by doing kind of uber things in the game. Like, you know, if you have three of every kind of icon on your board, or one of every kind of icon, then you can claim this achievement. There's also special cards that will allow you to claim them outright. Mm-hmm. They just count as regular achievements. It's not like there's anything super special about them, except that you have to get them a different way.
It's just something else to keep your eye on.
Yeah,
instead of something just you might be able to get. Scoring achievements.
Yeah. So, you know, the game will basically end when someone gets to that level of achievement. So, you know, what were you know, Do you want to do buy, try, or deny points, or just talk about?
Yeah, I'll do it real quick.
Yeah, just give me your rundown.
It was nice because, you know, I had a few friends that picked this up actually, and I never got a chance to demo it, and to me it just looked like a deck of cards for $30.
Yeah.
You know, not to go into the value issue, but you know that's what it looked like, and the art was, you know, not great, but playing it, this game is just so deep. It goes beyond just a normal card game. It's got you're managing what you have. You have to manage. You have to kind of keep an eye on what everyone's, you know, dogma actions are. You're seeing where the empty pile rule could affect you or hurt you, and you know, looking at special achievements. This game could get really deep tactically, and that's a good thing. I'm not saying it's overwhelming. You know, you still only have two actions on your turn, so there's not a lot of AP going on. But especially a two-player game, it can get really deep and really tactical, and it's a heck of a lot of fun. And it plays so quickly once you get the hang of it that you get that civilization building feeling, but in this much more tactical setting, and it's a lot of fun. The mechanics are really well thought out.
Cool. I mean, there really is kind of a chaotic element to it because there's the randomness of the card play, and you know that kind of makes it naturally tactical. I heard someone on Board Game Geek compare this game to Flux. What do you have to say about that?
They're wrong. Yeah. I guess both games have, you know, not great art.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, well, the new Flux actually probably is better.
They're both played with cards.
Yeah. I mean, that's. I like both games, but I like them for very different reasons.
Yeah, I think the complaint was that it's too chaotic, but I think you can really sort of mitigate that randomness by, you know, what you play and which actions you choose to play.
Oh yeah, you can set your course.
You just got to keep your eye on what the other people are doing.
Right. So yeah. No, they're wrong. Don't listen to people on BoardGameGeek, kids.
There you go. So I think we would both give this game a buy. I mean, my buy points are most everything about mm-hmm. it. Really, the only deny point I would give is that that's maybe a try/deny point. Is
Ooh.
That it's $30 for a deck of cards.
Yeah.
But having said that. You know, we railed before on Through the Ages being too expensive for being just cards, and we had our hands slapped soundly, but and rightly so. But for this game, I do not feel cheated at all.
No.
I've gotten a lot of great gameplay, and I think that it is going to retail for $30. I don't know about distribution right now as far as how you can get this game, but please pick it up because mm-hmm. it is really a fantastic game, and I think it's going to be on a lot of best of the year lists.
I agree, and you know the word that keeps coming to my mind is rich. It just feels like a very rich gaming experience
for such a short amount of time.
Yeah, you know, you're just like, man, I played a really kind of deep tactical game, and you know, with building a civilization, and that was only 30 minutes.
All right. Well, that's innovation.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Let's move on. So something else that I did this past weekend was I got an opportunity to play in the Spiel's 13th annual Formula Day tournament.
An exclusive event.
Yeah, kind of semi-exclusive, I guess. They seem to have expanded it every year. And
black tie. And
yeah. And I've been doing this for 3 years now, and the very first year that I played, I got last place. Last year, I got first place, worst of first.
Yeah.
And this year, I started off after the time trials in 22nd place out of 23 participants.
Not great.
Worked my way all the way up to 5th place.
That's
fifth
pretty
place
good.
Finish. That's not too bad, yeah. And so it was a great time, and it's one of the coolest run convention...
SpielCon 2011.
It's one of the coolest tournaments that I've ever been a part of. And then afterwards, they had dinner, and we just had some open board gaming, had a lot of folks stay. And so I got to play several games with listener Justin Moore and his wife, Ashley Moore.
Two great folks.
Justin Moore was actually the winner of the tournament.
Oh.
He had never played Formula Day before.
That's how it goes.
That's how it goes with the Formula Day. And we walked away with a jeweled steering wheel. So really good to hang out with them. I taught them how to play Railways of the World, the card game.
Great game.
In Stephen Conway's basement with his cat who had killed 3 mice that night.
Oh.
Yeah, the cat was on the prowl. She was like hissing at me. It was really kind of weird.
I don't deal with the mice well.
Well, apparently
we got the cat.
The
there.
Cat did, so that right. was good. We played that one. Played a lot of games. Carlos Hernandez, another listener to our show and to the Spiel, taught me and Justin how to play this game called Himalaya, which is it's like a pick up and deliver game, but it has programmed movement. It's like a real mishmash of games. It's like programmed movement, pick up and deliver game. With resource set collection.
Miniatures combat.
And no miniatures combat. No. and then it's also got kind of like a Reiner Knizia scoring mechanic at the end.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's the setting is sort of like you and your yak are walking around and like no, seriously, it's a yak. You and your yak are walking around to these different huts and temples and stuff and are picking up resources and delivering them.
Got it.
It was a cool little game. I was not
any game that starts with you and your yak.
You know, I was not very good at it, and I kept getting some of the rules wrong. And so, hopefully, Carlos and Justin didn't.
You're a podcasting professional, man.
I kept telling them I'm not very good at games.
Cut your salary.
So I enjoyed playing that one. I also got another shot at playing the card game Nile.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember if we mentioned that in our Gen Con episode, but this is a card game from Minion Games that is. It's got a sort of a feel of like Ticket to Ride, the card game. You're drawing cards and trying to lay down sets of cards, or like Bonanza. You're trying to like plant sets of cards and then harvest them. And it's pretty interactive, and there's a good amount of randomness to it. We played it at Gen Con and didn't like it at all.
Right.
But
it's printed on the worst possible stock of cards.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, devised. That goes without saying that really Minion Games, of all the things that they seem to be doing pretty well, card quality is maybe the worst I've ever seen in a game. But so you got to sleeve those puppies if you get Nile or any of their other games.
Sleeve them twice.
Leave no doubt. But it's a very interactive game. So I played like a 5-player game of that very late at night.
Yeah.
It was a hoot. I had a really good time.
Yeah, you were probably a little punch drunk.
A little bit.
I love Nile.
It was awesome.
It's the game you've been waiting for.
It was like 1 a.m.
Yeah, don't play Nile.
Okay. I'm going to say play Nile.
Don't play Nile.
Okay. Yeah, I'll leave it. We'll leave it up to you.
Intrigue.
Ooh. Conflict. And the other thing that I tried to learn how to play, another listener to the Spiel, Mark Wilder, who's from the Chicago area, he came down and brought this German card game called Scott, which...
like Scott Nicholson?
No. It's spelled S-K-A-T.
Scat?
Yeah, Scott. And... I don't even really know how to describe it, Cody. It's sort of like a bidding, trick taking game, sort of like bridge, you know.
Uh-huh.
But seriously, I thought at certain points Mark was just making up the rules because he would just be using terms that I totally didn't get. Mark did an admirable job, but I was just stupid and wasn't understanding what he was saying. So he's like, so you've got you're with one that plays two. You got hand three. You're going to be doing this overt.
It's a Thursday,
and then if you get the Schneider, then literally, if you're going for like 90 points, it's called a Schneider, and then there's a Schwartz. There's a Schwartz and a Schneider.
I see your Schwartz is as big as mine.
Let's see how well you handle it. But it was really halfway through the rules explanation, I felt bad. I was like, can someone come take my spot? Because I just don't understand this at all.
And you bailed?
Seriously, it may be the first game that I've ever just said, I don't understand, and I'm not going to be able to understand it. Isn't that bad? And I don't know. Because I've tackled some meaty games. I feel like I'm actually pretty good at learning.
You should have gone
games.
For the Doofenshmirtz Schneid there.
The Doofenshmirtz Schneid, yeah.
Jeez. bailing. You're giving our podcast a bad. I'm going to have to come in there, Ameritrash Games ablazing, and set the record straight.
Okay,
so this is how we do it.
I will try to get a Scott deck, and I will forward you the rules to Scott, and you can try to figure out what it's all about.
I think it's scat.
Okay. Do you think the Germans would pronounce it scat?
No, but.
But you're going to call it
We're
that.
Not in Germany, sir.
Okay. That's spoken like a true American.
Thank you. This is America.
This is America. All right. So we ended the night with the Formula Day tournament playing a game of Telestrations. Have you played this one yet?
No, but I've heard fun things about it.
Yeah. So it's basically a game of telephone, but it's played with...
It's Eat Poop You Cat.
For those of you who know that game, Eat Poop You Cat, it's a... Yeah, it's basically telephone with a dry erase board. So everybody has like this booklet of dry erase boards. You draw a card, some kind of a word on it. You write that down and then you draw it. Actually, I think it depends on the number of players. You might just pass it once you write the word down. But one person draws it, then you pass your book to the next person. That person looks at just that picture. Then they guess what it is. Then the next person, it's, you know, like telephone. And it is really a lot of fun. And it's one of those weird games that's... it's kind of an everybody wins game. There's really no scoring. Well, there is scoring in the rules, but the scoring's stupid.
Yeah.
It's like whoever had the most artistic one gets a point. You know, whoever had the funniest one. You know, you get the impression in your head of like those old Hasbro games where like the kid is pointing and he's like got the big, you know, smile on his face like it's just the funniest thing in the world. Yeah. So late at night, especially, the game is really good. So because you can just kind of go through and say, you know, I had milkshake, and then by the end of it, it's like, you know, motorcycle. And so
that is funny.
Well, it's funny when you go through the pictures. Don't be a jerk.
I'm just saying.
All right. So I had a great time at the Formula Day tournament. So thanks very much to Steven and Dave for inviting me to that. And, you know, I got my fifth place certificate there. Hopefully next year I can reclaim the jeweled steering
wheel. You got to step it up. That looked nice in here. Now the podcasting room has no jeweled steering wheel.
You should come next year.
Well, I will.
You should come be a part of it next year. So we'll see if we can get that to happen.
Godspeed racer, go. He's often flying as he guns the car around the track.
So mechanics is a word that we use in board games a lot, probably overused.
Not a real sexy word.
No.
You know, it's just mechanics.
And I'd never actually even heard that word, in this context, until I really got into the board gaming hobby. It's like no one was going to sit down and say, well, the mechanics in the game of life are pretty, you know.
Mm-hmm. But it's kind of looking behind the curtain. Because, you know, when I got started in gaming, it was neat because all of these games had these really different ways to play, you know. It wasn't a roll and move. And then as I got into it, you know, you start seeing similar things popping up.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh.
Oh,
that's
great.
All I got, yeah.
Yeah. So as gamers, I think that's something that we tend to really care about a lot more than the average person. I think the average person going to Walmart and just picking out, you know, their copy of Game of Life or whatever, they just want to know, is it fun? You know,
right.
And we care about it being fun too, but you know, we're more concerned with the specifics of why is it fun?
No. That's one of the first questions you ask when, you know, you hear about a new game. Oh, you know, what kind of mechanic does it use? Is it a, you know, is it a roll and move? Is it a, you know, worker placement? Is it pick up and deliver? Yada, yada, yada.
Right. And I think that word mechanic has really come to mean a lot of things. Like someone said, what kind of mechanics is that? Oh, it's a zombie game.
Yeah.
You know,
what? So,
zombie's not a mechanic. But I think.
Well, certain game companies even, like you could describe a Steve Jackson game almost as a mechanic. Like, oh, it's not a really good game, but it'll sell a lot.
Yeah. Well, just like when I was talking about Himalaya a second ago, and I said, it's got a Kinesia scoring mechanic.
Yeah.
You know, it's like now it's associated with a guy. So we just wanted to just talk. We've been thinking a lot about mechanics because we've played a lot of interesting things lately.
Well, with all these deck building games you know, I've heard many different, because if you think about it, and I think at Myriad Games presentations at Table Talk, they mentioned that maybe that moniker is not exactly right because you're not really building a deck. You're more drafting, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but, you know, so I've heard deck construction games or, you know, drafting games. I don't know.
Yeah. And so that mechanic is one that is kind of new on the scene. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go back 15 years to like Settlers of Catan, you know, something like simultaneous actions, you know, it was kind of a new kind of mechanic. The fact that one person was rolling the dice, but then everybody got to play. Everybody was getting their resources at that time. That was really a very strange concept, I think, in 95. You know, now, of course, there's, you know, dozens, hundreds of games that do that kind of thing. But when a new mechanic comes onto the scene, I think that people kind of stand up and take notice. You know, I think that the last few years, the big mechanics have been deck building, thanks to Dominion, and you know, cooperative games, I think, have become huge as well. And you know, those are the two just kind of glaring things that you see over and over again. And there have been some good ones, you know. So, I mean, I guess, what are your, Cody?
Hi.
What are your favorite mechanics, or what kind of, or what mechanics do you hate, you know?
As far as favorite ones, and this is one I actually think will be the next big thing after deck buildings, are your hybrid games. Games that have, you know, you mentioned Himalaya was kind of like this.
Yeah.
I've not played it, so I can't speak to it, but you have, you know, like the new Settlers of America game, the Trails to Rails, that to me is a really good example, because you kind of have the Catan, you could even call it a Catan mechanic, you know, because it's Catan.
You know, it's that archetypal, you know, at this point.
With resource management, and then with a lot of, you know, Empire Builder railway type of mechanics. You've got, you know, these three or four really odd things that shouldn't go together, but they go together really well.
Yeah.
You know, I like that, and I kind of like the one-shot mechanics, like, you know, with World Without End, you know, where your placement at the table, your physical placement at the table matters as far as how cards and actions come into play. I really like those.
So now what I would challenge you is that would you consider a hybrid game to be a mechanic, or are you just saying that you like, you know, this conglomeration of multiple mechanics in the game? Because
you could go either way. I mean,
because I think if I say that something's a worker placement game, then I already have an idea in my mind that you have little meeples or something. Mm-hmm. You're going to be putting them on a board, and then later on in the round, you're going to be pulling them off the board and getting some kind of resource for
it. You're never going to have enough for what you everything you need.
There's worker placement. Well, but if someone were to say to me, oh, it's a hybrid game, I'm not sure if I would know what that means, other than, oh, it must be a combination of a whole bunch of things.
Well, I mean, they could even say, you know, it's a hybrid worker placement and pick up and deliver.
Okay.
You know.
But you're saying that that's where you think things are going.
Yeah. I think you're going to see, it's like, well, what if we mix deck building in this, or we mix, you know, cooperative in, you know.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of room for that.
That's a good point, because these deck building games seem to be sort of standalone at this point. Even the ones that we're going to talk about, Heroes of Graxia in a minute here, but, you know, Heroes of Graxia is deck building, and, you know, for the purpose of combat, you know, and Thunderstone is kind of like deck building for the purpose of going to the dungeon, and you know,
and it's a terrible game.
Quiet you. Dominion is deck building for the purpose of buying victory points,
right?
But we have not seen yet, that I know of, a hybrid deck building board game.
No,
where you build a deck as a partial mechanic to doing something on a board. I mean, I could definitely see something like that coming out sometime soon.
Yeah.
I don't know what that would be like, but I'm not a game designer.
No. Other mechanics I like. With the right group, I like the trader element.
Cooperative with trader.
Cooperative with a trader, because that goes hand in hand with one of my most hated game mechanics, and that's the cooperative game.
Okay. Now, this is interesting.
Because every cooperative game I've played, there's always one guy or one or two guys, and sometimes I'm that guy, that just directs traffic, that just says, you know, because it's open information.
Yeah.
So you know, at some point it even ceases being a game and is more like a puzzle. You know, like Forbidden Island kind of goes into this. You could even do that with Pandemic. You can say, okay, well, you know, if you've got this and this, we'll just go here. Because, you know, some people are natural leaders and some people are natural followers. You know, it's I'm not saying those people are bad that kind of take over, because sometimes it's me. But, you know, it seems like the quieter people get kind of shouted down a lot, and they're just, yeah. And it's not very fun for them.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay. Well, that makes it. But when we add that traitor element.
Yeah.
But when you add that traitor element in, you want to be the traitor, right?
Most of the time, yes. Although in BSG, it's just getting tiring. Like, the last six or seven games of Battlestar Galactica I've played,
you've been a Cylon.
I've been every time. And, like, I don't even want to be at this point, because, you know, I'm a Cylon, and everyone's like, well, you've been a Cylon the last six games. We're going to go ahead and brig you just to be sure.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, and I can't.
Yeah, wait a minute, game.
and I can't show them and be like, haha, see, you know, you shouldn't have brigged me. It's like, yep. Yeah, I'm a Cylon.
So if you're playing a game that's a cooperative with trader mechanic, and you're not the trader, do you still have fun with it?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fun kind of rooting things out and looking at the, you know, the little things and looks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Other mechanics, like, I like the, and again, I don't know if this is a mechanic per se, but the large group sustainability, I guess, to make up a word. You know, games like Werewolf. I can't really think of many.
Games like Werewolf.
You know, like the Action Castle thing even I mentioned.
Uh-huh.
You know, something that you can stretch to 20 people.
Okay, so something that's just really good for large
but
groups.
But still fun, you know, not just a silly game where, you know, it feeds off of the large groups. And I really like some of those social interactions you get.
And do you think that's partially due to your, not that you have great, but you have experience in LARPs.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when you get a large group like that, I mean, not that Werewolf's not a LARP, but it's got that same sort of social element to it.
Yeah. Where it's better than a LARP is that it kind of, you have to interact to a point. I mean, with a LARP, you can have people, you can have, you know, wallflowers.
You just want to sit and watch what's going on.
Yeah, right? Or, you know, that, you know, maybe their character isn't someone that necessarily, you know, the other characters would talk to, or they purposely, you see a lot of this in LARPs, they purposely make the outcast character, which is dumb for a LARP because you're just going to stand off in the corner for 6 hours while everyone else plays.
Yeah.
With Werewolf, it's like you have that group dynamic, so you have all those different personalities, but you're forced within the game to interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's really neat.
Cool. Well, we have a couple of emails from folks who wrote in about mechanics.
Yeah.
And one of those is from Michael Cillian Hackinson.
I believe he is from Sweden.
I believe so.
Let's go with Sweden.
It's definitely a Scandinavian country. If we've gotten your country wrong, Michael, we apologize. And he says, my favorite game mechanic is double guessing or second guessing, where you have to know what your opponent is thinking and what would benefit them the most and what decision would make what the decision they would make with the information options that they have. And he mentions games like Lord of the Rings Confrontation, Maharaja, the Fist of Dragonstones, and StarCraft, the board game. And I would even throw in that the game I mentioned before, Himalaya, is a very similar game like that because of the programmed movement part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going around to these cities to get resources, but you have to get the resources in a particular order. And because it's secret program movement, you have to decide, do I want to wait until my opponent goes in and gets the lower value resource so that I can go in and get the higher value? But he may not do that, but I don't know.
Yeah.
And so that's
where you can really think yourself into a corner.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a very interesting, interesting mechanic. I think it's one that I'm not too terribly fond of because it is just such a brain burner, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then if I'm planning on that person doing action X and they don't,
it's the Princess Bride thing.
What do you mean?
The I forget the actual line, but you know, there's one cup that doesn't have poison in it.
I can clearly not choose the one in front of me.
Right, yeah.
Okay, I see.
You know, it's kind of, you get that and you end up thinking yourself into a corner.
But, okay, yeah. Yep. Well, so Michael, thanks for writing in and telling us that.
He also sent us an email about Will Wheaton's keynote at PAX.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, PAX is, I believe, either going on or about to go on.
The one in Seattle?
Yeah.
Okay.
PAX yeah, Prime.
PAX Prime.
You know, and we're definitely want to go to that sometime.
Yeah.
But just hearing, you know, Will Wheaton has become this surprise voice. Not to go off on too much of a tangent here, but it's like, you know, he mentioned Small World a month or so ago, and that game's been out, you know, many, many months. And that game spikes in popularity.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, well, where were all these people before? And Small World's a fine game, but goodness gracious.
Cool mechanics in Small World.
Yeah.
Yeah, that whole, you know, the conquest thing with the, I don't even know what you call that mechanic, but
I like how you got us back on
top. The cardboard chit mechanic. I don't know.
And of course, Will Wheaton's group was one of the nine that slayed the dragon in True Dungeon.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah, I'm sure that was completely on the level.
Oh,
I'm just, yeah.
Don't hate.
Come on, he somehow ended up with the purple +2 long spear of dragon slaying.
Yeah,
and he just happened to slide it exactly in the way where it instantly killed the dragon. I'm just calling shenanigans. I don't think they're on the level there.
Okay, Cody.
I'm just saying. That dragon was
want
too...
some cheese with those sour grapes?
That dragon was too freaking hard. But okay. Anyway, we have another email.
Okay, from, go ahead.
I believe it's Bob Rademaker, or Raidmaker. I'm going to go with Rademaker. He says he really enjoys our podcast. Well, someone has to.
No one has to, really.
You guys work well together. Please consider including discussion of one of my favorite mechanics, the Rondel.
The Rondel.
What is the Rondel?
The Rondel is it's kind of a way of determining your actions for a particular particular turn. Games like Imperial and most recently Finca.
Oh yeah,
has a Rondel mechanic where you have your little guy, your little meeple or whatever, is sitting on there, and how many points or the actions that you're able to do are on this Rondel, but where you're able to move on the Rondel is based upon. At least in Finca, it's based upon how many other pawns are on your space. So, if you have three people in your space, then you're able to move exactly three spaces, and you know, and so you're able to kind of figure out by moving around the Rondel, you know, where do you want to go? What actions do you want to do? Do you want to take it? And you usually have more than one of these little guys you can move around, and so if you you might choose to go ahead and move that three spaces if there's three people on there, or you might want to wait until someone comes up and onto that same space on a later turn so that you could then move four spaces. So it's a very different way of choosing what actions that you're going to do on your turn.
Would World Without End be considered a Rondel, the thing at the bottom of the board?
No, because that's not really the way that you choose your actions. You're talking about the favor track on the bottom. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like a Rondel in reverse because you're able, you make your choice of what you want to do. And then based upon that, you're going to get certain, benefits from it, but I'm not sure what that mechanic would be called. Anyway, he says, thanks again for our work we do to enhance our enjoyment of this great hobby. Thank you, Bob. And, good podcasts like yours make the daily commute and walking the dogs much more enjoyable.
Hey, that's what we're here for.
No, yeah, I listen to other podcasts while I mow the grass. That's kind of my big thing. So thanks for that email.
So what are your mechanics? What are your favorite and least favorite mechanics?
Okay, well, one particular mechanic that I like that I've only seen in a couple of games that I think is very cool is the mechanic that they use for turn order in the game Thebes. And also, it's also used in the game Red November, which is the one about the little guys, gnomes, that's the idea that you can, on your turn, you can pretty much taking time to do particular actions. So around the outside of the board is basically number of minutes or whatever, or hours or weeks or whatever it is for the game, and you'll say, I want to spend 2 weeks to do. This particular action, and you'll move your little thing forward, and you basically you can have as many actions as you want until you get to the point where you're not the person who's in last place. And then the person who's in last place would get to go. And so you can choose to, you know, take a giant action that would take eight spaces that'll shoot you forward. And you might get great benefit from that action, but then you're going to have to wait around for all the other players to do multiple actions and ahead of you. So I think it's a real good way to, in Thebes, you haven't played Thebes,
no.
But that's, we should play that one because I think you would like
that mechanic.
That
sounds really interesting.
Yeah. Cause you really get to sort of plan out what you want to do. And it's sort of a way to. You can choose to make yourself go ahead, but then you really have to kind of pay the price by sitting and waiting for someone to do possible multiple small actions.
Right.
So I really like that mechanic. That was one I thought of. I really like the I wouldn't call it a role selection mechanic like Puerto Rico or Citadels. I don't particularly like that kind of mechanic.
You hate Citadels.
I don't like Citadels. No, but I do like the idea of like action cards or games that come to mind for me are Rune Wars and World Without End. Actually, we mentioned that one several times for cool mechanics. Where you have a handful of cards of things that you can do, and on your turn, everybody kind of turns one over, and you know, you say what you're going to do. So I really like that. And in World Without End, it's cool because you have 12 cards, but every round you're only going to play six of them. So you have to make the decision of I'm going to play this one, but I have to put this one away because I won't be able to use that one this round. I think those are some interesting decisions in games.
Castle for All Seasons has something like that too.
Does it? Okay. And then in Rune Wars, that's just great because the way the supremacy bonus works in that where all the cards are numbered 1 through 8. And as long as you play them in order, from lowest to highest, then you get this supremacy bonus because you get it if the card you played is the highest one that's been on the board. I guess I like mechanics where you're allowed to do extraordinary or odd things, but you kind of have to pay a price for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, I don't really want to play the number two card. I want to play the number eight card. Well, that's great. You can do that, but you basically, and you can maybe get ahead by doing that, but then you're going to have to pay the price by not getting to do cool stuff for the next three or four turns.
Yeah, that's good. Good choices.
So I really like those mechanics a lot. And then sort of the last one I want to mention is I like dice rolling combat resolution. I just, you know, any games that have that, because that's kind of from role playing and from miniatures games as well. I just like it when, you know, you're fighting a monster, or you're fighting somebody, and you're rolling dice to determine how that happens with modifiers and stuff like that. I think that's fun.
Now, what mechanics don't you like?
What mechanics don't I like? What did you talk about mechanics you don't like?
Yes,
you did. Okay,
I said cooperative games and.
Shoot, this is like being at a restaurant where you're like, oh no, you order first. I'm sure that I'll know by the time it comes around to me.
Yeah.
I guess I don't like abstract strategy games, but that's almost too broad to say because I do like Hey, That's My Fish is an abstract strategy game, but it's with penguins, you know, so it doesn't feel quite like that.
So you and I are on completely opposite sides of the fence on the Ice House Pyramids.
Oh yeah,
because I mean that's not so much a I'm lumping everything under mechanic. I like the idea that I have these five colors of pyramids and I can play 100 different games. Essentially, they're pretty much mostly abstract strategy games, just different themes. But
yeah,
that's not up your alley at all.
It really isn't. Yeah. those Ice House games that have and those have varying mechanics, but anything that where you're manipulating some kind of just nondescript thing that doesn't represent anything,
right.
You know, it's
checkers or
well, I mean, when we did the interview with the designers of Railways of the World, the card game, they mentioned that the original design for that game was not a railway design. It was just sort of this thing about like connecting nodes together. It seemed like it was very abstract, and I was like, well, if they had ended up releasing it as an abstract sort of game, I would have hated it.
Oh yeah, I'm with you there.
And yet, the fact that they just happened to put this railway theme on it, I think it's a great game.
Yeah.
So I think that's it. Is that I just don't like playing games where I'm moving pieces around that have no link to any meaning whatsoever. Even if they try to link it to a meaning, like the game Samurai by Reiner Knizia. I'm not sure if you ever played that, but it's a game where you're placing meeples and you're placing different pawns and things onto the board, and you know, it's an abstract game to be sure. You know, where you're trying to get the majority in certain areas, but just the fact that they made them into little Buddhas and stuff, and they made it on a map of Japan, that's enough for me to say at least they tried to link it to something.
Right.
When there's definitely no linking to any sort of theme, I don't like that.
I'll get you on the pyramid bandwagon.
No, you
there's
won't.
A lot of cool games for that.
Okay,
I just like the pyramids. I guess I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I'll stick with the Looney Labs card games. I like all right. those because they're themey.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those are some of the things that we like as far as mechanics go.
Yeah. So, but the reason we were really thinking about this is that all of a sudden we are just seeing this just huge influx of deck building games or drafting games or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
You know, there was Dominion, and then there was kind of like a year lull where everyone's like, is that going to work?
That's when everybody went. Deck. That's when everybody went to their basement and said, "Oh, it's time to."
Yeah, everyone's kind of looking over the fence and being like, it looks pretty successful. It's making a lot of money." So at Gen Con this year, I mean, you couldn't spit without hitting three people with a new deck building game. You had the Resident Evil deck building game, which looks cool.
I'm gonna
have to try that one out. You had Heroes of Graxia, which we're going to talk about here in a minute. You have Ascension: Chronicle of the God Slayer, which is made by people from the Magic Pro Tour. You have Thunderstone expansions, and there's probably a bunch that I haven't even mentioned.
Yeah,
but you know, it's just funny to see a mechanic that no one would have even thought of. One of them catches fire, and then you see just a dozen of them coming out of the worker.
Yeah, the Fantasy Flight folks are coming out with the Blood Bowl card game.
Yeah,
that's a deck building game. But you know,
why don't they just remake that game? Just not a variant of it. Just remake Blood Bowl.
Yeah,
I'll buy a copy tomorrow. You know.
That might be something. There's some kind of like living rule book where all the rules have changed over time, and people that still play the game have bought these updates. I'm not sure how easy it would be to.
Oh, they'll buy another update then.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, it seems like that is a game that the Games Workshop folks could pull a Space Hulk on and release a new version of that. But yeah. Anyway, so yeah, but deck building games, definitely the hotness right now. And you know, I demoed both Ascension Chronicle of Godslayer and Heroes of Graxia, and I bought Heroes of Graxia, and so we're gonna do a review on it. Was that a tad abrupt?
A little bit.
Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to launch into that so quickly there. So yeah.
That's how our conversations go sometimes. You just shout, you're going to do reviews at me, and music comes in from somewhere.
You're really peering into exactly how our friendship works.
Review!
Okay. Okay, here's music. So, yeah, Heroes of Graxia was designed by the folks at Petroglyph Games. Interesting game company here that is sort of trying to bridge the gap between video games and board games and card games.
Keep building.
So they've had games for Xbox Live Arcade, and I think there's a board game version of this Graxia world called Guardians of Graxia that's also coming out. I think that one's also going to be an Xbox game as well. So they're really trying to integrate both of these things together.
I imagine you'll see this one on some sort of platform.
Yeah, and we can talk about that in a second. I think that might not be a bad idea, actually. Yeah. But so Heroes of Graxia is a deck-building card game where you basically take on the role of like a some kind of fantasy hero, yeah. And you're building up a legion or an army of, I guess they call it legion in the game, big army of guys that you're then trying to use.
Dudes,
yeah. That you're then trying to use to either defeat monsters that are on the board. And when I say board, it's just stacks of cards like Dominion, you know, to defeat monsters. Or in this game, you can actually attack other players, which is something that you can't do in like Thunderstone. So that's one thing that makes it a little bit different is that you can actually attack.
But you'll quickly find there's little point to doing that.
It's definitely difficult. Yeah. So much like Dominion and all these other games, you're going to start off with a specific deck of cards. Unfortunately, you know, like Dominion's real easy. 7 copper, 3 victory, 3 estates, ready, go. This game, you're starting off with 12 cards, and they're all different, and they're all very different. So, yeah. I mean,
The setup time's a smidgen longer.
Yeah, digging. So if you buy this game and then tear it down, you might want to take the starter decks and maybe put them in some bags or some sleeves, special sleeves or something. But you're going to start off with this deck, and you know, much like Dominion, you're going to be drawing up a certain number of cards, of 5 cards, and then on your turn, you're going to be able to buy cards, and you're going to be able to play cards in front of you. One of the key differences between this game and a lot of these other deck building games is that there's going to be a lot of cards that are going to be laid out in front of you. So there's still the mechanic of when you buy things, they go to your discard, and when you acquire things, they go to your discard, and they end up, you know, recycling back into your deck. But you're also going to be having cards that will lay down on the table and will stay there. So you have 4 different rows of cards in front of you. So it's a total of like 16 little piles or 16 cards available to you. So there's a spell deck, a unit deck, an equipment deck, and a monster deck. So the spells, units, and equipments all just represent cards that you're trying to acquire. Units are going to be, you know, things like armies and mercenaries and minions and henchmen and things like that that are going to help you to fight. Spell decks are going to be things like instants and other buffs that you can give to your
global enchantments, interrupts.
Yep, things like that.
Sorceries.
Thank you, former magic player. And then you have an equipment deck, which is going to be weapons and
artifacts.
Stuff.
Artifacts.
No.
Equipment.
Artifacts and equipment, yes. You made me say artifacts. No, like armor and weapons and things like
Pearl
that.
Pearl medallion, glasses of Urza.
Okay, yeah, you can pipe down now.
Sorry.
And then you have a monster deck, which is going to be the things that you're going to possibly be able to fight on the board. So on your turn, you're able to do you're able to do several different actions. And the weird thing is that you have just a ton to choose from. And I thought this was kind of a clunky part of the game because, I mean, you got like a list and the rule book here, you got like a list of 12 different things you can do.
Yeah.
And there, it's maybe a little bit hard to keep track of what things you're able
Speaking of the rule book, not a top shelf rule book.
No, it's not even a book. It's basically a piece of paper that's been folded a couple
of
times.
A leaflet.
It's a leaflet, yes. And yeah, not very, very well organized. We definitely referred to it a lot in our first game. But the idea here, and just as a broad overview, is that you're going to be laying down cards on the board, which are things like your armies and your equipment. So you can equip weapons and things like that to your armies. You can equip them to your hero itself. Your hero actually comes with a card. You actually also get a little miniature for your card, which you use to kind of keep track of what's called your loot pile, which is the stuff that you're going to acquire later on.
Kind of useless.
You didn't really need to have a miniature. I mean, it's kind of cute, I guess, yeah. but that's about it.
Yeah.
And so you're going to be equipping things much like, you know, Magic the Gathering or those kind of things. You're equipping stuff and you're playing spells and things like that. And then you can also choose on your turn to attack one of the monsters that's on the monster row. And it's basically a pretty simple procedure of you have attack values that are one particular icon, and you're going to add all those up, and then the monster is going to have some kind of a life value. If you have more attack than the monster has life, then you kill the monster. Then the monster is going to attack you back, and he's going to have an attack value, which is usually a pretty big number. Mm-hmm. And then that's going to be measured against your defense value. So you add up all the defense icons from all of your units and armor and stuff like that. And then any excess, like if he's dealing 20 to you and you have 15 armor, well, then that's going to deal you 5 wounds. The wounds are represented by separate cards, and they're kind of multi-use cards in that one side says 1, one side says 2. You turn the card over, it says 5, and then 10. So you can just kind of pile these up, and then you'll apply those wounds to your different folks that are in your army. And you can even also give yourself wounds if you want to. And so that's kind of the main crux of the game is building up your army and then fighting these monsters. And then where it gets a little bit complicated is that you can fight other people's legions. And this is where it becomes a very somewhat tedious math game, I think, yeah. Is that, you know, you want to attack someone else. You're going to add up all of the abilities of your legion.
And these numbers can get into the 60s, 70s, 80s.
Yeah, if you have enough stuff in front of you. Yeah. And then you're going to basically say, I'm attacking you with this. And then they're going to pull out all their defense values. And it's a lot of, you know, get a calculator out and figure out what the difference is.
This is where the Heroes of Grexia Xbox Live game, you know. Oh, yep. It auto-calculates.
Yep, yeah. And that's where I think that this if they turn this into an Xbox Live game, it could be very, very good. Because the concept behind it is neat, I think, you know, of getting all the stuff and buffing out your army and then attacking stuff to get these points. And the other thing that you're going to get is if you attack other legions of other opponents and you destroy armies or destroy certain things, you're going to get what's called prestige points, which are sort of the points that will allow you to, you know, win the game, yeah. I guess.
Victory points.
The victory points and stuff like that. So, you know, the game is going to end when the monster deck is exhausted. That's going to end immediately. And then you're going to count up victory points. And the victory points will be like the monster cards themselves. There's like a little goblet, looks like a little trophy, and a certain number of points for that. So you add up all of those. Some of the cards that you've bought, like spells and certain armor and certain enchantments and that kind of stuff, will also have victory points that you'll apply.
So much like the end of Dominion, there's usually a kind of a last-minute splurge to buy anything that has a goblet on it.
Right.
You're like, yeah, that spell, I'll buy it, sure.
Yeah, yeah. And so then the other way that you can win or that you can end the game is that when you attack a monster, all you're going to get is like the monster card and get those victory points. If you attack another player, then you're going to get what's called prestige points. And then depending on the number of players you have like a 2 to 4 player game. If you get 15 prestige points, that immediately ends the game and you win. But getting those points is really tricky because you know, you want to be real careful before you start, you know, attacking someone else's army, because you could end up losing a whole lot.
I just think you'd get left in the dust.
Yeah.
I mean, unless everyone else was focused on PvP.
Yeah.
You know, I think you won't have enough time to get your points, and then by the time the game ends normally, you just won't have anything.
Yeah, so we found that in our game, we played a 4-player game of this, that it, I think we did a couple of things where we were attacking each other, but mostly it sort of, that became such a tedious task of trying to add all that stuff up that it was like, it's just easier just to fight a monster. You know, let's just fight the monsters. And that was the way the game ended. Was
and I'm used to D&D, you know, where it's like, okay, well, I've got, you know, there's a bless and I'm flanking him and, you know, he's under a spell and, you know, the dim lighting. So I add adding all these modifiers. It's like, you know, like I mentioned, you're getting into the 60s, 70s, 80s with some of these numbers. Yeah. It gets a little ridiculous.
And some of the card abilities are pretty cool. So, I mean, that, you know, it's not like that the game wasn't well thought out. It's just, I think it would be best as a video game because it, just of all that math that goes along with it. Yeah. So I think it, with a, it, we have not tried it as a two-player game, and I think that we're going to give it a shot as a two-player game at some point to see if it's if it plays a little bit shorter and not quite as tedious. But I just sort of found that the fun started to I was building my army. I'm like, this is pretty fun, and then it just sort of started to diminish as I started trying to add up all this stuff in my head.
So what you're saying is you should have bought Ascension.
Well, I did do a demo of Ascension, and yeah, I think that was probably would have been a better choice for me. So I might have to pick up a copy of that one and we can check it out. Because did you get a chance to play that one at all?
I did not. I've heard good things.
Yeah. So, I mean, the overall rating for Heroes of Graxia, it's kind of a mid-level, you know, kind of a... Of all the games that are out there, you know, I wouldn't put it... the deck-building games, I'd put it kind of low.
Yeah.
But
if we were to use our system, I would probably give it a deny.
Okay.
I mean, it's just... Yeah. There are better things you can play.
Yeah. The price point is not terrible, I guess, for what you're getting. And I don't know what they're going to do about expansions. I'm sure expansions will be based upon how well it sells, but... but keep an eye open for that Xbox Live game if it comes out.
I bet it's coming out.
I think that might be pretty good.
That's pretty bad when we're like, oh, the board game is terrible. Yeah, but the video game version, check
well, that's
that
a criticism I've heard of this company is that their video games are pretty fun, you know, but then the translation to board game has not been quite as good. So there's Heroes of Graxia. All right, so we're coming towards the end of the episode, and we're going to do voicemails.
What? Up is blue, left is green.
It's a world gone mad.
That's right.
Dogs and cats living together. Yeah, exactly. All right, so we got a couple of voicemails on the Game On hotline.
Yeah.
And one that's
very strange.
A little suspect. Yes. From a listener named Steve. Let's have a listen.
Intriguing.
Hey, Cody and John. This is... Steve. I was listening to the latest episode, and I was really interested in your description of the true dungeon run that you guys did at Gen Con. It sounds like a really interesting thing to do, and I was really interested to hear more about it. And I'm hoping you can elaborate just a little bit, because I'm a little troubled by the success rate that you guys were talking about, how there were maybe only 12 people who successfully completed this dungeon. And I'd like to know, is this a one-off thing? Is this like a single quest that that happens each year and you start from the beginning? Or do you have a character that you continue at each Gen Con and go back into the dungeon and get more experience and make that particular character stronger? And if it's the latter, how do you even start a new character if you have no hope of going after... of completing the quest that you're up against? For example, if I can back up to video games for a second, it's really my only frame of reference. If you're playing Dragon Quest and you start the game, you're not going to run into a dragon right off the bat. You're going to run into one of those cute little blue slimes because they're easy to kill, and that's how you ramp up. Wouldn't it make sense if there were some sort of starter dungeon? A first-time player's version of this game, it just doesn't seem to make sense if the only way to be successful at the game is to have been playing it for the past 6 years. I'm hoping you guys can elaborate on this. It's confusing me, and I'd love to hear more. Thanks a lot. Love the show. Bye-bye.
So thanks, Steve.
Yeah, Steve should go into voiceover work.
Yeah, Steve should get a job at voiceover work. He might be good as a podcast co-host. With maybe a guy in Florida or something.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. Yeah.
But to answer Eric's question, with True Dungeon, there's kind of a difference between character and player in that as a character, you don't level up a character through the years. Every dungeon you play is a self-contained one quest. There may be a story arc that lasts 2 or 3 years. For example, this year was fighting the dragon Smoke. The year before it was a lead up where you're getting information on how to do it. But each quest, you can go into it like it's your first year and just run it. And then the story ends there. So you pick a character class, you know, like I pick Bard, but You know, it's not a Bard I've leveled up since 2005. You know, he has the same stats every year. Every so often they'll update the characters or maybe raise them in level. But you don't have to worry about being behind the curve in that regard.
Where you do have to worry about being behind the curve.
Yeah. I'll get into tokens in just a minute. But as a player, that you get experience for each year you do True Dungeon and whatever dungeons you run. Again, this is just, you know, at the end of the adventure, they, you know, they ask your name and they have a token, or not a token, well, it's invading that too.
Yeah, right?
You know, and they just enter your points into that. And, you know, I think the highest level people, I think there's a few people that are actually like seventh level that have played since the very, very beginning and done multiple runs. I've been playing since 2005 and I just hit fifth level. And those player levels give you certain small benefits. You can participate in certain True Dungeon events, or you get into the tavern for free when they have one. You know, but it doesn't
have very much to do with the game itself.
It has almost nothing to do with the actual game. So you can go in. That's where you don't have to worry about being a new player, and you know, you won't enter as a first level character and be paired with, you know, eighth level. Everyone's the same level, so to speak, as far as character.
Having said that,
they do have these infernal things called the treasure tokens.
Yeah, we've talked about them a lot.
Yeah, it's really nice because the tokens help generate income for True Dungeon, help them to buy new props and new set pieces, and they really bring out some cool stuff. Like we mentioned, the dragon was really neat. There's a bit of a power creep in it, though. It's almost like a CCG, really, you know, because they have the different rarities, and you know, there's this, you know, some tokens, some older tokens are going for $500, $600, $700. I wish I was joking. I'm not.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that, but the nice thing is, you know, it's not a competitive event. It's your group versus the dungeon. So, you know, you get what tokens you need. And it sounds like next year they're going to have different difficulty levels. They're going to have, you know, like a beginner level for new groups where you just have your starting pack of tokens that you get for signing up for the event, and that's what you have. You know, they have an expert level for people. You know, I would probably fall into this one where I've done the event a bunch of times, but I don't really spend a ton of money on the tokens. I have a small collection, but nothing fancy. And then they have nightmare level for people who are min-maxed and have all the cool purple gear and
very little money.
And very little money because they spend it all on tokens. And then finally, to address the survival rate, this year was definitely a down year. And it wasn't so much 12 people, but it was more like 10 groups. Groups of eight.
Which, given how many groups they through in 4 days, that's still a very, very small.
Still very, very small. Most of the time, how it goes is most groups will make it to the final room, the final challenge, whether it's a puzzle or a combat. And the survival rate is usually 20 to 30%. Because the last puzzle or combat is usually pretty tough. But if you've got some really savvy people or good combat sliders, you can make it through it. I think Jeff Martin's gone on record and said that the difficulty will not be what it was this year. This was meant to be a very hard challenge, probably too hard, and it's going to be rectified a little bit. So I wouldn't get too worried about that. And I think if you come in even as a new player, I think you're going to find that you'll be able to get in. It's more who you group with. It's like with World of Warcraft or stuff like that. If you're with a pickup group, people you don't know. You know, I've heard stories of these groups running through that just wanted to get the tokens, and they would solve all the puzzles because they've been through the dungeon three or four times. They wouldn't even give the new players a chance. And that, I mean, just don't be a jerk. You know, that's a basic principle for me. But if you get in a good group, say a podcaster run, you know, I think that's where you get the most experience.
So the bottom line is, Eric, Steve, whoever you are, you need to come to Gen Con.
Yes.
Because really, True Dungeon, it's almost exactly like Merchant of Venus. It's just themed differently.
Absolutely.
All right.
I've not played it, but I'll agree with you.
All right. So we have one other voicemail from the Game On Hotline from Mr. Brian Smith. And let's have a listen.
Hi, Cody and John. This is Brian Smith from Columbus. I enjoyed your Gen Con's review very much. And I'm thinking about what you were both saying about how Indianapolis has embraced Gen Con. I think you're right that a lot of that has to do with Indianapolis enjoying the money that Gen Con brings in, and also Gen Con knowing how to market itself. I think also, though, that a lot of the restaurants and bars kind of catering to the Gen Con visitors might have to do with the fact that really nerd interests are a lot more mainstream now than they might have been back when Gen Con first came to Indianapolis. The movies are more popular. Lord of the Rings swept up awards when it came to the Oscars. And so maybe it's just not as much of an uphill battle as it used to be. People will come to see that stuff, and they'll enjoy the people in the costumes. So anyway, just wanted to give my two cents. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for that message, Brian. And
I wonder which Columbus he's from. I'm assuming it's Ohio.
But I'm assuming, yeah.
There's Columbus, Indiana, not far away.
Yeah.
Home of Tony Stewart, race car driver.
Yeah.
So about the voicemail.
There's a Columbus, Georgia, too.
Okay.
Okay. This is really fun to talk about the different Columbuses.
Exactly.
All right. So, yeah, he was saying about Indianapolis.
Yeah. I like the idea of nerd interests.
Nerd interests.
For the next presidential election, that needs to be. Mr. Obama, what are your nerd interests? You know, what how will you further nerd interests? But he's absolutely right. You know, it's, you know, with things like Lord of the Rings and even shows like, you know, Big Bang Theory.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, they were playing Talisman on that show one time. Yeah. You know, most people have never seen Talisman in their lives.
And I love telling my non-gamer friends, you know, do you watch the Big Bang Theory? And they're like, I love that show. I'm like, those are my people. You know, and they're like, oh, I understand you better now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's funny because a lot of the non-Gen Con attendee friends that I have that, you know, live locally, a lot of them will say, oh, yeah, I like to just go downtown and people watch.
Yeah.
You know, it's just neat to watch that. And, you know, and most of the time it's not in a derisive way. They're just, you don't see an elf walking down the street every day or a stormtrooper in a kilt.
Right.
You know, so that's kind of neat for them. And, you know, as we mentioned in the episode, I really think it's just going to keep growing. It's a win-win relationship between the city and Gen Con. So
yep.
Here's hoping it just gets better.
Now I'm sad again because it's like 11 months away.
Yeah, but you're going to BGG Con.
That's right, I am.
So woo! Shut up. It's like I have to wait for Hoosier Con, and that's in March.
Oh, it's going to be okay.
If you go to hoosiercon.org,
I think it's, I don't know.
Yeah.
Nice plug. Well done.
Hoosiergamers.org, and then that will take you to Hoosier Con. We'll be there.
All right, so we've done a little bit of voicemail, a little bit of email. We got one more email.
Uh-huh.
And it's time to resurrect, I'm going to call it a segment,
uh-huh,
that I like to call the GM Academy.
Oh.
Yes, it is once again time for the GM Academy. Chancellor Cody Jones presiding.
It's good to be back.
All right. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
Okay. We have an email from Wade Kemper.
Hi, Wade.
And he writes, I've been struggling lately with DMing.
Mm.
I'm the only willing DM in my group, probably the most seasoned vet in our 4E game. For the most part, I believe I'm doing a decent job, but nobody takes the time to express their fun or thank me for the work that I put into the game beyond the cursory end of night goodbyes. I'm even okay with that, but there was a recent incident with a player who called me out for some things that were clearly my fault, and some things that simply came down to me not being prepared for this player's murder of my plane-shifting gnome NPC. Long story, he says.
Yes.
Anyway, he quit over it and screamed at how bad a DM I was for railroading him, etc. The point is that all I could think about while being berated was, hey, I have a full-time job, a 2-year-old, and a baby on the way. I'm finding time to prepare the game so you can have a good time. Why are you attacking me? So my question is, how do you combat DM woes, namely the feeling of giving so much without getting much back? I love D&D, and I don't see this as a catalyst for me to stop running games, but it's been bothering me lately, and I was hoping for your input.
Wow. The problem you have is one that I haven't had anyone scream at me, but... You know,
I'll get right on that.
You're terrible. But you really do question yourself, even with a long campaign, where you're preparing what you think are good games, and everyone's saying, you know, this is fun and everything, but you don't get anyone come out of their way and say, hey, I really had a good time, thanks for preparing that. You just don't see that a lot. With as far as the problem with the guy who screamed at you, don't let the door hit you on the way out, you know? People like,
not worth it.
Yeah, just toxic people. Goodbye. What I've found and what I'm going to do in future games that I run is there's kind of an implied social contract when everyone comes together. Just, you know, we have them in anything we do, just an accepted practice and way of doing things. It's not a bad idea to set that out at the start of a new game, or even you could probably even do it now. You know, you could say, you know, to continue this game, I just want to lay down these rules. And, you know, by playing in the game, by coming to the table, you are accepting those rules. And these aren't tyrannical things. My wife, Kaylin, just started a Pathfinder game. And she put out a really good example of what I consider this to be. You know, she's saying, you know, I may house rule some things. I may make some rulings on the fly. I don't want any rules lawyering or arguments at the table unless, you know, like a character's life is on the line. You know, I may change some rules around. I will more often than not defer to the players, but, you know, the game's not going to be slowed down by rules arguments or anything like that. And you can put whatever you need to put in there to tailor to your group. But, you know, I think, you know, you have to assume kind of you're all adults here, and you have to say, it's okay to step away from the table for a second and just say, you know, out of game, guys, I'm, you know, I've got a 2-year-old, I've got a baby on the way. I'm bringing you a game weekly, bi-weekly, monthly, whatever it is. You need to work with me a little bit too, because I'm here to have fun as well. You know, this is a group exercise. So don't be afraid to kind of take off the DM hat for a second and, you know,
there's a hat involved.
Well, you have to be a high-ranking member of the Academy.
Oh, okay.
You know, the Chancellor.
Okay, gotcha.
But don't be afraid to take that hat off and say, you know, let's just talk as friends. Let's talk as adults here. You know, my expectations of the game are X, Y, and Z. Get everyone else's expectations and work out something and say, you know, going forward, let's do it like this and make sure we're all having a good time and we can make this game really great.
That's so touching. Hey. Aw, that's
nice. So it's gamers can really... And this has happened with me and my own group before, where it's you fall into the game,
yeah,
and you don't really interact like
normal people.
Yeah, you know, it's just like you know, it's like you can be a jerk and, you know, not even realize it. Where if you did that in a normal kind of setting, you would really notice it, and other people would probably call you out on it.
Yeah.
So kind of just bringing up that social contract every now and again when you need to, or when you start a game, I think it's a great idea. And if everyone knows each other's expectations and limits, I think, you know, most of the time, unless you get jerks like the guy who was yelling at you, which if you're yelling at me when I'm bye,
you're gone.
I don't need you.
Yeah.
Right. You know, if everyone knows expectations and limits, I think the game will just flourish, because I think people will respect that most of the time, and you can continue to grow. One other thing you may want to consider is if you're all D&D players, did he say 4th edition?
Yes.
Okay. You may want to start, you know, Wizards has, you know, this D&D Essentials and these Redbox games. I don't know if that's the route you want to go, but they're making it easier and easier for people to learn how to DM. And if you maybe can cultivate one or two people that you think would be really good, you know, that could be good at DMing, you can say, hey, you know, you can practice on us. You know, we'll be forgiving and, you know, we won't, you know, berate you for it. You know, this would be a good time to maybe start building up your bullpen, so to speak, and go on a rotating schedule. Or, you know, hey, we'll do John's campaign for a year, then we'll do Cody's campaign for a year, or 6 months, or whatever you want to do. But use the products that are out there, because they're really making it easy for new people to get into it, especially on a DM level. So that may, you know, you may have a little DM burnout too. It happens. Yeah. So explore that as well. But good luck. Let us know how it goes. And if you have any other questions, the Academy is always open.
Except that now the Academy is
closed.
All right. Well, thanks so much for that email. And these are good tips for me as well, since I will be starting my very first game as a GM. And I've been talking about it for like a year.
Yeah.
It's going to happen this month or next month.
Oh, I'm going to yell at you. Yeah. I'm just going to be on your back.
That's fine.
I will have memorized the rule book. I will call you out on every rules discrepancy.
I'm bigger than you.
I'm faster than you.
That's probably true. Okay, so that is the GM Academy. And yeah, I think
that's a show.
I think that's a show. Let's wrap it up.
Well, as always, that was another fine episode of Game On with Cody and John.
Yeah.
Thanks for bearing with us as we explore this new format and a way to bring content to you.
Sorry, didn't mean to step on you there. let us know what you think of the new format and whether you like it or don't like it, and that may not alter whether we change it or not, but you know, because we like to do what we like to do, but we'd love to hear your feedback on it.
Yep. So Wayne will give you all the ways to contact us. We love emails, we love voicemails, we love anything that you can send us as long as it's positive and
nice.
No, sorry, I kid. But one other way that you can stay connected to the show is our Twitter feed. We've really been we've kind of revived the Twitter feed in the last couple weeks.
We both have sexy phones now. That's so right. We can both update the Game On Podcast Twitter.
My iPhone being better than his Android phone, second rate.
Okay.
But if you admitting defeat, you
can
follow.
There's no point in fighting, really.
You can follow us on Twitter at Game On Podcast. And our next contest will be announced on Twitter. Now we'll announce it sometime after the episode is dropped. So if you're following us on Twitter, you will know everything you need to know for the contest. And what are they playing for, Wink?
All right. Well, they're going to be playing for a copy of the brand new game in the 10 Days series from Out of the Box Games, 10 Days in the Americas.
Ah.
So brand new copy, courtesy of Out of the Box Games. And yeah, so be watching the Twitter feed. Please follow us on Twitter. And you know, we update. What we've been doing lately is when we have our game night, we'll take pictures of what we're playing. So you can get that information before we talk about it on the show. And you know, we'd love for you to interact with us that way. And if you'd be keeping an eye on that Twitter feed, we'll be putting a contest out there. Mm-hmm.
Wink Martindale, he still alive?
Wink, I think so.
Good for him. Okay, so again, that's at Game On Podcast on Twitter, and everything else Wayne is going to tell you. So until next time,
Game On.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games, on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 413-8-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at gameonpodcast.com. Join our guild on BoardGameGeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Game On Podcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on PulpGamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Game On!